who tried to get Edward to join one of the organizations of the PLO. And he told me, Edward is unorganizable. Right? But why did Edward affiliate himself with the PLO? Right? I mean, remember, the conjuncture is 1974. 74, you have the Arab League states that the PLO is the representative of the Palestinian, the only representative of the Palestinian people, the only legitimate representative. Then later, the UN invites the PLO and Arafat to address the General Assembly. 74, the UN recognizes the PLO as and gives it observer status. So for that trip, it is people like Mahmoud Darwish, the poet laureate of Palestine, and Shafiul Hout, one of the most important political figures of the Palestinian movement. They want to meet Edward because they don't know him well. And second, they think he could help them in rendering Arafat's speech to English with proper translation and diction. That is how Edward is pulled into the process. And he obviously then forms relationships that last for a lifetime. You know, Mahmoud Darwish writes a poem about him later, about Edward Said is in the heart of Palestine. So I think Edward has a couple of notions, if I may backtrack. Filiation and affiliation. He affiliates, that is, he makes a choice. Filiation is a tribal connection, right? You're an Armenian, I'm an Armenian, so we're part of the Armenian tribe, right? Or we can be the non-Armenian Armenians, the non-Jewish Jews. Edward was of similar notion. He hated nationalism, but he supported nationalism. He's the non-national national, right, in that sense. So he chooses to affiliate as a way of expressing and supporting Palestinian cause in the fields in which he excels, which is the university, the media, and the public. And that becomes an important figure because they needed him to affiliate. And he chose to affiliate at a risk. He was vilified. And of course, the number of people who vilified him and organizations are too long to list. Because Palestine was seen as, you just don't affiliate with Palestine and Palestinians.
You're listening to Nubar Hovsepian on Edward Said, an oppositional intellectual. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. So you mentioned Mahmoud Darwish, the national poet of Palestine. In Edward's book, After the Last Sky, he quotes the couplet by Darwish, "Where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky?"
It's, you know, interesting you bring that up. This is probably the least reviewed book by Edward, After the Last Sky. And the person who makes such a strong claim that it is not reviewed sufficiently is a former student of his who, I think he's still at UCLA, I'm not sure, Amir Mufti. And he writes a wonderful essay on this subject. Edward's After the Last Sky is a meditation. It's a book with two essays. One, photographs, right? Jean Maur, right? I remember first attending the dinner with Jean Maur and Edward and Shafiul Hout in Geneva, sitting on the lake of Geneva, beautiful restaurant, in which Shafiul Hout brings up the idea, why don't you guys team up together to do a book? And I suggested, well, maybe it's like After the Seventh Man, that Jean Maur and John Berger produced on migrant workers in Germany, right? They proceed to do that. These two essays complement each other, but Edward's words are, how should I put it, pensive. He's forlorn. He's not giving in. But it's a sad book, I think, because the reality is sad. But it's also a way of depicting a people who still insist on clinging to their land, to their nationality, to their existence in their home, in their homeland. So in that sense, it's a wonderful book. I wish it was reviewed more. I think it was incredible.
You quote him saying in After the Last Sky, continuity for them, the Israelis, the dominant population, discontinuity for us, the dispossessed and dispersed.
Yeah, discontinuity is precisely the Palestinian story. The ruptures, continuous ruptures, continuous expulsions, continuous forms of violence marshaled by the Israeli forces with total silence of the world.
That brings us to Gaza today.
Precisely that, right? I mean, so we have the English Prime Minister saying this is not good. Well, get off your butt and do something about it, right? So these are all perpetrators of genocide. Their silence is deafening, right? And irrespective of which administration, you know, the Palestine question and the war on the Palestinians. It's not a war on Gaza. It's a war on the Palestinians in Gaza as a location. But there's also a simultaneous war taking place in the West Bank. At least 50,000 Palestinians have already been displaced in the West Bank during the war on Gaza, right? And more settlements. Area C, which is under Israeli control based on the Oslo configurations, is being settled to the point where the settlements have just become incredibly widespread. And they have eliminated the possibility of seeking a two-state solution, which the international community still clings to, but they don't tell you what part of Palestine is available for the second state. None of it is available right now because the Israelis, and especially with this criminal government of Netanyahu and all those ministers, right? I mean, unfortunately, you have a bunch of fascists running the state of Israel, and American media does not call them out for their fascism, right? So I think what is taking place in Gaza today is the extreme expression of what Edward mentions in the quote you just brought about, exclusions. It's literally now a genocidal war of ethnic cleansing, right? And we see that every day.
And that genocidal war is aided and abetted by the United States of America.
By United States, America, and companies like
Boeing, Microsoft,
right? So a lot of the technology they use for their drones and all that, I mean, they are technologies produced by American corporations, right? So you have one company whose CEO, whose founder is against this and gets arrested, Ben and Jerry. So the rest have no moral compunctions.
The sheer scale and level of destruction of what's going on in Gaza, and also I should mention the annexation of East Jerusalem, and as you mentioned, more and more land being confiscated in the West Bank, which has clearly been targeted for further colonization. The sheer scale of the death and destruction has created, I think, some openings at least for some critical views to get through. Not much, but at least it's not that 100% monolith that has so characterized U.S. attitudes and European attitudes towards Arabs, Islam, and the Palestinians.
See, I think we have a major divide between officialdom and what's happening in American society or European society. You see massive demonstrations throughout the world, whether it's in London or Rome, Now, unfortunately, none of the massive demonstrations have happened in the Arab world. And we probably know why. I mean, too many authoritarian regimes preventing their people from expressing their views. In America, I think one of the interesting things is that a lot of people who used to consider themselves pro-Israel and Zionists have come around. They have become critical. I mean, one figure in particular whom I find very endearing and very admirable is Peter Beinart. Peter Beinart's book on Zionism over a decade ago starts the first line with, I'm a Zionist. Peter Beinart's latest book on Jewish condition and the Gaza war is clear. He sees the futility of a two-state solution. Now, if a two-state solution works, nobody will oppose it. But show me how it will work. It's not working because the Israelis are gobbling up the land. So the younger generation, and we see that in universities across the country, are improving the American discourse in academia, in certain working class areas, right? Does it affect policy? Zero. Go back to the anti-war movement. The anti-war movement against Vietnam did not affect policy until later. It took a long time for then the Congress to decide, wait a minute, we have to do something. Right? So we're not there yet when it comes to Palestine. In fact, we are still in the moment where American policy bluntly supports genocide with no excuses, with no moral compunctions.
You quote Omar Bartov, an Israeli historian, professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University, talking about, quote, the Holocaust has given license to Israel to oppress others in the name of its victimhood. And Edward always talked ruefully about the fact that the Palestinians were the victims of the victims.
See, I think that's an important observation. I remember when I visited Yad Vashem, some of my Palestinian compatriots were critical of my decision. And one of the interesting things about the Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial, right, is you go through it, and then at the end, the resolution is Israel is founded. So out of the ashes comes Israel. It's a simple story. No conflicts, no occupation, no war, etc. Right? It's just a simple claim. Now, the problem, I think, Israeli society has difficulty accepting, with a few, the exception of a few writers, you know, who probably are not listened to in Israel anyway these days, who see that the Holocaust enables the silencing of critical thinking about Palestine and Palestinians. Among radical right-wing Jews, the Holocaust means that they have the right to do anything to anybody as to protect themselves. And my point would be, here I invoke my Armenian background, that is, we must conclude with a universal lesson. Not a particular lesson. The universal is that our humanity is at stake, all of us, right? It's not just the people who are perpetrated against. We have to learn that the lesson of the Holocaust has to have universal answers. And unfortunately, it does not. And I think the key person who rejected universal lessons, somebody who I address and critique heavily, is Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel essentially never found anything about Israeli policies to be critical of because his role in the construction of the narrative about the Holocaust and its impact on the Jewish soul, right? And people, mainstream people like Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, who was a colleague of Edwards for a while at Columbia University, wrote a major critique of how can he do that? That's not our moral tradition. That's not our Jewish tradition. Now, of course, people like Sarah Roy took him more directly, you know, saying, you don't see Palestinians. You don't see, you know, so he described Jerusalem as their city. He says, but you don't see Palestinians who live there? He is morally blind, right? So I think the only way we can think about genocide, Holocaust, etc., is by extracting a universal lesson. If it only is a particular lesson, humanity has no future.
You spoke of Palestinian ruptures, multiple ruptures. 13 September 1993, the Oslo Accords, celebrated with great fanfare here in the United States. Edward Said was furious. He called it a Palestinian Versailles. Arafat had given away much and got almost nothing in return. Although invited to the White House ceremony, Edward refused to attend. His critique was trenchant and spot on. Negative repercussions of Oslo for Palestinians continue to this day. There you see a complete breach with Arafat and the clique around him and Edward.
See, in many ways, Edward had a soft spot for the leadership, which is normal, right? National liberation movements have a singular objective, which is to achieve the rights of their people for self-determination. Critiques of leaders are postponed, right? Edward, before Oslo, launched a critique of the leadership, and Oslo opened the door wide open. What was Edward's problem with Oslo? The Palestinian leadership had essentially given up on mass mobilization and resistance as a price for pursuing Oslo. In other words, the history of the Intifada that precedes it is simply muted, relegated to the sidelines to pursue a diplomatic objective. The reality is of struggle is that the mass mobilization has to be in conjunction with your diplomatic solution. What were the problems that he had and others? If there was any small chance that Oslo worked, nobody would have been against it. I wrote something about it as well, and I said, I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think so. Well, history has proven us not to be wrong. What is it? Israel never admitted to be an occupying power. Now, that's an incredible omission. If they're not an occupying power, then they can easily claim that this land is theirs, that Palestinians are intruders. Well, isn't that what Netanyahu and his cohorts are doing today? They're doing it in Gaza. They're doing it in destroying several refugee camps in the West Bank, right? So the Oslo critique was important. Stay outside to represent the unity of your people. To Edward's misfortune, he was right, because that misfortune means that people continued to suffer, to have their lands taken, their water supplies taken, being imprisoned. In other words, being denied their human existence, their national existence.
Is Said's work read and studied today in the Arab world? Do young Arabs know about him?
Of course, a lot of Arabs know a lot about him. I think the biggest disservice to Edward was the way the translation of Orientalism happened, right? Now, Edward chose the translator. And I speak now from direct information because I was part of the publishing group that published Orientalism in Arabic. And I think some of the critics pointed out that the translator saw himself as an equal partner in the production of the book, which is an ego larger than that. I'm not going to mention his name, but I think the turgid translation killed that book in Arabic. So anybody who read the book in Arabic probably did not fully comprehend the complete oeuvre that Edward had produced in Orientalism. And it's not a book that was easy to begin with, you know, in English. Aside from that, his works have manifested themselves in a variety of ways. Edward chose to address Arabic audiences through his syndicated columns in Al-Ahram Weekly. A lot of his books have subsequently been translated, but they were translated well. Fawaz Trabulsi has done an incredible job in translating Edward's memoir.
Out of Place.
And Out of Place, right, and other books. And I think the reception in the Arab world is interesting, right? And I write about that on my chapter on Orientalism, that, and this is where a lot of peculiar things happen. Some view Orientalism from the standpoint of kind of culturalist, Islamic understanding of the world. Some critiqued it for producing an equivalence between Orientalism and Occidentalism. And that was the critique by Sadi al-Azm. Till now, Edward's best-known writings are his journalistic or essays, right? His political writings are widespread and well-read, and he was someone to consider, to the point where, at least in my work, I consider Edward to have been both an exile and an Arab writer. In other words, an exile is part of the Arab world. In other words, geography doesn't eliminate your affiliation, but it informs your perspective on the relationship between these two.
His seminal book, Culture and Imperialism, is, you write, heavily influenced by famed Canadian pianist Glenn Gould. That might surprise some people.
Edward keeps thinking about point, counterpoint, right? That's to some extent, this is Gould's method of playing, understanding of music. Edward is looking at point, counterpoint throughout. And the music informs him about the particularity of a place. It informs him about the style that's important to look at and the performance. He obviously liked Gould a lot, and he wrote a lot about Gould in his music columns for The Nation.
What is Edward Said's legacy?
In one of my trips to Palestine, with Edward being there, he met with a group of Islamists at Bir Zeit University. And those students told them, look, Dr. Said, we differ with you a lot, but we respect you because you speak the truth. This is something that needs to be valued. Cabral writes, tell no lies, claim no easy victories. That gives Edward a certain moral standing of, despite his achievements, he doesn't hide behind his achievements. He speaks truth bluntly, to the point, and to serve the interests of his people. In that sense, I think that is his greatest forte.
Talk about Sumud and its importance.
Yeah. Look, I mean, Palestinians have exercised Sumud, which is steadfastness, right? And despite the adversity, they cling to their not only land, but their identity and their demand for self-determination, right? Now, I don't want to speculate on the future. I mean, Edward's view was that there is no solution without being interconnected, right? Jews and Palestinians are interconnected, intertwined. There is no solution in separation. So he was against separation, whether it was in Ireland or in Pakistan. Separation is not a good formula. In fact, it's a perfect colonial formula that didn't work well in South Asia and in Ireland, right? So, and in that sense, all that I can say about this is, as long as Palestinians and the people in solidarity with them remain steadfast, the future can be bright. It looks bleak right now because we just see too many people dying, too many people killed, not dying. They were being killed by Israeli ferocity and genocidal war, you know. But despite that, there's still that spirit. We want to live in peace and in freedom, right? That's all I can say about that. I don't want to speculate more than that, you know. For my generation, it's a dark time because my time is less than, say, a younger generation left. So I hope in your time as a young generation, there is more hope than I see today.
Thank you for your time, Nubar.
My pleasure, David.
You were just listening to Nubar Hovsepian on Edward Said, an oppositional intellectual. I spoke with him in late May 2025. Nubar Hovsepian is Associate Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Chapman University in Orange, California. He's the author of the book, Edward Said, The Politics of an Oppositional Intellectual. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Vijay Prashad, Peter Barnert, Angela Davis, Gabor Mate, and Arundhati Roy. And we have a series of programs with Edward Said. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Nubar Hovsepian on Edward Said, an oppositional intellectual, and for my two books with Edward Said, Pen and the Sword and Culture and Resistance, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU and AUC Press. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
To Massive Music Weekend on WRCT Pittsburgh. From Friday at noon to Sunday at midnight, we'll be spinning 60 straight hours of our favorite artists and bands, including live performances from five local bands. You can visit WRCT.org to view the full schedule for our annual music marathon. Piatta Italian Street Food is a spot for fresh chopped salads, tossed pastas, and toasted piattas, their take on an Italian-style wrap. With five locations in the Pittsburgh area, they've got options to satisfy a variety of cravings. You can find Piatta in the Northway Mall, East Liberty Shadyside area, Oakland on Pitt's campus, South Hills near Mount Lebanon, and in the South Hills Robinson area. You can follow Piatta on Instagram at Piatta Italian Street Food to stay up to date on all things Piatta. I've gotten a half hour of antenna. Yeah. This is Camino del Sol, their title song, the title track off of the release Camino del Sol.
You.
was Achilles, the 1983 Island demo version off of En Cavale, which is a compilation of Isabel Antenna's works. And before that was Jaffo and Eno. This is To Climb the Cliff.
Thank you.
On the boat, where I feel like their antennas, no wave, new wave, post-punk, strange electronic influences are extra prominent. Before that was En Français sur Mars, Silly Things, and Bepop, the 1983 Island demo. And yeah, I got one song left.
Young and brown and tall and lovely, the body from see, I think, shifting patterns in the interconnections of anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, and misogyny spiraling together with Islamophobia, transphobia, anti-Asian racism. First, an important quote from Heschel, reminding us of the importance of not despairing. Racism is an evil of tremendous power, but God's will transcends all powers. Surrender to despair is surrender to evil. It is important to feel anxiety. It is sinful to wallow in despair.
That's Doris Bergen, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Doris Bergen on anti-Semitism, anti-Black racism, and misogyny. Bigotry and hatred, fear and loathing are on the rise. Vulnerable groups are being targeted. It's happened before. Decades ago, speaking to the National Jewish Congress, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "My people were brought to America in chains. Your people were driven here to escape the chains fashioned for them in Europe. There are Hitlers loose in America today," King warned, "both in high and low places. As the tensions and bewilderment of economic problems become more severe, history's scapegoats, the Jews, will be joined by new scapegoats, the Negroes. The Hitlers will seek to divert people's minds and turn their frustrations and anger to the helpless, to the outnumbered," unquote. Our guest today is Doris Bergen. She's professor of Holocaust studies at the University of Toronto. She's the author of many books, including War and Genocide and the award-winning Between God and Hitler. She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder in February. And now, Doris Bergen.
It seems extra important to be marking these times designated for learning, for remembering, for aspiring together. They're not the same, but there are many asymmetries, but there are also many connections. And of course, this is the subject